Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Even in these tense times, as ICE and Border Patrol ramp up enforcement across the city, neighbors are stepping up and finding creative, generous ways to take care of one another. From raising funds to grocery runs, the acts of solidarity are everywhere. We talked with two local artists and philanthropists who are turning concern into action. Now, don't forget to stick around for a breakdown of the latest local news in and around Chicago after this conversation. But first, let's jump right into the episode that you clicked on. Joining me at the table was Irais Sosa, who's co-founder and CEO of Sin Titulo Shop and the Neighbor to Neighbor program, which organizes grocery runs and other services for folks who don't feel safe leaving home. And Delilah Martinez, who's a social entrepreneur and founder of the Mural Movement. She founded Operation Buyout this year to help support local food vendors. Irais kicked things off with more on her Neighbor to Neighbor program.
It was a program that was started out of a reaction to what's going on and just trying to create moments of peace for our neighbors. Anyone is able to apply on our homepage, and we are providing free grocery runs that includes pickup and drop off to their home, and in addition, free Lyft gift cards. So then if they do have to leave their home, they at least have a sense of a little of minimizing the risk of being out and about.
Yeah. And, you know, you brought up what's going on, right? What was it that you stood out to you, Irais, and your group that made you identify that, you know, the procurement of groceries, that's going to be a need for this community? We're going to have to step in, and this is a spot where we can help.
Yeah, it was actually a personal story. I had a loved one message me, and she asked me if I could deliver her a pizza. But she doesn't even like pizza. So to know that that was her only source of trying to get food because she didn't have anything in her home, I was like, okay, this is something that I know is extremely needed. So it came from that.
So she was just trying to keep it simple with a
pizza.
She
really was. For her, like, takeout is just, like, such an advanced thing. So the only thing that we grew up with is pizza if we didn't have anything in the home. So that is legit what she went to.
That's such an immigrant thing. I mean, I'm from the Caribbean islands as well. And that it's a, you know, takeout is like the very last resort, right? We're very used to our home cooked meals and getting our own groceries to be able to do that. What other errands or services are you providing?
Anyone is able to apply and just kind of write out what they need. For the most part, people are sticking to the grocery runs and the Lyft gift cards.
Yeah.
But someone yesterday actually messaged and said, I'm not even taking my kids to school. So I made a note on our sheet to give them school supplies for at least to continue the learning at home. So I'll read what individuals say, and even if they're not asking for it, we'll try to provide that.
Yeah. And even if they're one-off requests, it sounds like you're willing to be flexible.
Absolutely.
And try to make it happen. Delilah, I mean, you both live in Pilsen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell us about the arrival of ICE in your community. So take us back. You know, what was it like initially? And tell us more about what you've been seeing personally.
So I own a business in Pilsen. I'm also a community member. My family is from there. So one of the special things about Pilsen is, you know, our street vendors, our culture, our arts, the music we hear, people playing, the seniors walking around, just, you know, people playing instruments and just seeing the same people every day in our grocery stores. But when we first heard about ICE coming to our neighborhoods, or they were here in Chicago, the first thing I noticed is our streets were like dead. Mm-hmm. We didn't really see people out. I didn't see the same seniors walking around. I didn't see the same Balletero walking around. And so that really just changed my whole day, because every day I have, you know, I go to the gym, I drive through the neighborhood, I stop at the grocery store, and I just didn't see the same people out. And it made me really worried.
Mm. So tell me more about what prompted you to then create Operation Buyout.
So, you know, I'm founder of the Mural Movement. We tend to have the same mission. We meet the people where we're at, where they're at, wherever community they're at. We figure out their needs and we create solutions. So right away, when I noticed that our streets were very scarce and that the same culture and fabric of our neighborhood wasn't out, it really saddened me and I felt completely powerless, because I'm like, I don't know how to help, especially with the fear instilled in my people and just people of color in general. And I couldn't really think of anything right away. But within a few days, I did see a few of the street vendors coming out because they had to make money. And then I became worried for them. Even though I miss them, I became more worried because I'm like, man, you know, like, now they're putting their self at risk. And some of these street vendors I see their kids with them. Yeah. I see their kids after school meeting them. And it just really scared me. So I started to myself just give them extra money. And then I was like, man, you know, like, I really wish that I could give them more money. And I just felt like I couldn't. And so.
So enter Operation Buyout, right?
Yeah. So then I came out with this Operation Buyout where I'm like, you know what, let me just buy them out. And I wasn't thinking of anything like a couple hundred dollars. I was literally like, whatever they got, I'll buy it, you know? So I started with that. And then I started to just go on my social media. I'm really good at crowdfunding. I have the most amazing support from my social media following. People I don't know, people I do know, small business owners, like our local community leaders that support me. And I just told everybody, if we all pitch in a dollar or more, mm-hmm. we'll be able to buy out street vendors for a minimum of $300 to $500. It started with that goal.
And so the response, it sounds like it's been really good.
Yes, it's been really good. We quickly were able to raise $500, and then we started to raise it to $600.
Wow.
And now we're at $1,000 per street vendor.
That's
plus
incredible.
Necessities.
That's incredible. Security, you brought this up, you know, privacy. These are big hurdles right now. And so I can just imagine how those people are feeling. Like you said, the kids are exposed, they're exposed, but they have no other choice trying to make an income. I'm thinking, though, about people volunteering for you. Are you taking any measures to keep them safe?
Yes. Well, so for me, especially with doing crowdfunding, I always like to show content, like to show people where their money is going. But I've had to take extra community measures with having security, having rapid response, having people there to talk to the people, get to know them, blur their face, you know, like making sure that we can't tell where we're at. I'm also been for myself. It's like, as much as I want to promote it to raise money, I am scared myself to promote it and shine too much light onto myself, because then I'm thinking, am I putting the people at risk?
Yeah.
Am I putting myself at risk? Am I now a target? You know, because I own a business and people know, or, you know, they see me in the neighborhood. So it's just been a very scary time all around.
It's a lot to wrestle with. Irais, how are you thinking through that?
Definitely the same. I was agreeing to everything that Delilah was saying, because we have so many volunteers right now. Well, over 1,000 people applied to be a volunteer, but we did keep it close-knit to, it's going to sound like a lot, but 200 volunteers to help with these grocery runs. But even myself, like using my phone number, like now I have to think about like getting a second number just for this.
Wow.
And I get individuals messaging me saying like, hey, I want to volunteer. So-and-so sent me your number. And I was like, I got scared. Yes, it's for a good reason. But at the end of the day, there's a fine line of wanting to help out and trying to get the word out. But then it's like our safety, other individuals' safety, our volunteers, our recipients. So I genuinely didn't know it was going to be as big as our initiative is. So I thought it was going to be just myself doing the grocery runs. Our donations from our shop was going to be a part of this. But no, it became a bigger thing. And I had to work from something so grand and then try to reel it back in and be like, okay, all of these operations have to be done in a correct way. I talked to my accountant. I talked to an attorney that was a volunteer. She's like, hey, I'm an attorney. Did you want some advice on this? And I was like, yes, please. So we have a volunteer guide on just guidelines that are best practice for this because it is very sensitive, even
so
though
many
people,
ways folks are stepping up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. What happens, Delilah, once folks, what happens to the food once it's bought out?
So, what we do, at first we started to buy out people, but now what I do is I just go directly to them and I just give them the money. Because at first we wanted to buy out people, but then what we realize is they still want to make money on top of that. And so whatever, you know what, I trust them. We're just there to support them. So we go talk to them. We get their story. We figure out any other needs they might need. And then we give them the money.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Delilah, you are actually no stranger to philanthropy because I'm thinking back to summer 2020. That's when you actually started the mural movement. And it was in response to the murder of George Floyd. But this, what we're doing in 2025, this is a different response. Talk to me about that.
Absolutely. Like I said earlier, the mural movement is no stranger to showing up for the people. We like to meet the people where they're at, figure out what they need, and create solutions around there. But this is very different because of the fear that's instilled in our people and the extra safety measures we need to take.
Yeah.
One of the first things I noticed with Operation Buyout is we were going to buy out our local paletero. He's in his 80s. I've been seeing him for years. And I was so excited because I still see him out. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait to reach the goal. Can't wait to reach the goal. And finally, I saw him with my friends. And I'm like, let's go, let's go. And so when we approached him, and first we act like we're going to buy something and we're about to buy it. And then we started asking him questions. And immediately, his body language changed. He got really scared. And he pretty much started running off. He didn't want to make the sale. He started running away from us.
Wow, that instant fear.
Yeah, and my friends, it kind of scared us too because we felt really bad. But I really encouraged me and my friends to push forward and like keep going because one, I didn't want to see him later and now he's scared of me. And two, I really wanted to give him the money. And then once he realized we were there to help him, give him the money, I could tell he had some calmness. And then he started to tell us his story and how hard he's been working.
Yeah. Irais, Sintitulo has an initiative that helps fund educational resources in Mexico. And you also advocate for mental health awareness here in Chicago. So talk more about how you view the role of artists as activists.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from an individual standpoint, I always valued giving back. Even before I started up my business, like I knew about Delilah and everything that she was doing. So I was, from an individual standpoint, trying to see how I could implement myself. So then once we started up our brand, that philanthropy initiative that you mentioned was one of our very first ones. And our events with mental health discussion is trying to provide that resource for individuals. So bringing it full circle on our apparel and advocating, elevating our voices without speaking, but also being a resource to heal those voices through mental health discussions that are as low as $2.50 to attend.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking back to your mention of the 200 volunteers out doing grocery runs every day. Were you surprised just by how many people have been coming out in support of your programs and this community?
Yeah, it's a beautiful disaster, I will say, because it is so intense. Like right before coming on this, like I was messaging all of our volunteers. It's numbers, it's Zelling money, it's shifting all of these funds, and it's a lot. My mom yesterday asked me, and she's like, why do you have a headache? I'm like, because I'm looking at numbers so much. And I thought I was going to step away from spreadsheets, leaving my corporate job, but no, here I am back at it.
Yeah.
So appreciate all of those fundamental skill sets of trying to stay organized, because it's really important to make sure that I'm handling these donations with care for not only the individual that donated, but also to the recipients.
Yeah. How are you thinking through that, Delilah? I mean, has it blown you away, all the folks that have stepped up? You said you initially thought, oh, maybe 500, that's all we'll get, $500.
Well, I always like to put emphasis that everything I do is a collective effort of the community. And I just really love my community and my social media following. It's a lot of people I don't even know. And I feel like everybody wants to do something. And sometimes we're all like lost, like, what can we do? Like, we all feel powerless. And that's why I make it really easy. Like, it's a dollar or more. Or if you can't afford that, just sharing, telling a friend, telling your job, telling your boss, telling your corporate office, you know, speaking up for us in rooms we're not in. And so I just really love the power of community. And I always say the mural movement is for the people, by the people.
Yeah. Well, last word to you, Irais, for folks listening right now who want to help, but they're just not sure what to do. What would you suggest is just that first step?
I think the first step is to check in with yourself and make sure, like, are you in need of anything or your immediate circle? I think especially in our communities, we're always looking to help others, but then sometimes we also need the assistance. So I would suggest that. And then if you are open to helping us out, we are still accepting volunteers. I'm going to find a way to either have like some sort of newsletter. So even though you're not in the group chat, you can still assist Great. In other ways. We're going to do a lot of on the ground initiatives just with the amount of money. I just want to get the money out there versus us having it in the bank account and trying to process it all. So trying to get it as out as possible. And that's going to help with our volunteer newsletter that we're going to have coming out.
Yeah.
And you can donate on our homepage as well, or also share the resource to individuals that need the assistance.
Nice. And while I have you both here, someone just called us and they're wondering if these programs are only available in Pilsen. They're wondering if you're working in Little Village too.
Yes. For us, some of our street vendors we bought out were in Little Village.
So
as
Operation
well.
Buyout is happening in Little Village.
We meet the people where they're at, wherever nice. They're at.
For neighbor to neighbor, we're doing a 50-mile radius. So anything in Chicago and in the suburbs.
Wonderful. Irais Sosa is co-founder and CEO of Sin Titulo Shop and the Neighbor to Neighbor program, organizing grocery runs and other services for people who don't feel safe leaving home. And Delilah Martinez is a social entrepreneur as well as founder of the Mural Movement. And she founded Operation Buyout this year to help support local food vendors. Ladies, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
Okay, now it's time to catch you up on the big stories of the day. At the table was WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane and WBEZ environment reporter Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco. And from the Chicago Sun-Times, government and politics reporter Mitchell Armentrout and reporter Violet Miller. Mitch, I want to start with Mayor Johnson's proposed budget. Hearings kicked off yesterday, and the city needs to pass a budget by the end of the year. He's got several new tax ideas swirling around this time, a lot of them getting scrutiny, including this plan to tax social media companies. First of all, what is that?
So this is it's a fairly new idea. There's a couple other states that have tried to do this, are trying to do this. There's a bill in Minnesota, another one in Washington State. The idea is that you would tax companies like Meta and X and Reddit, big social media companies, a 50-cent fee per user beyond the first 100,000 users. So, you know, that would add up to a lot of money, presumably. It's hard to say because these companies don't have to publicly share how many users they have in a
right.
certain jurisdiction. There's all kinds of questions about how you would actually enforce this.
Yeah.
But there's also bigger First Amendment questions because, you know, there are similar taxes have been, governments have tried to levy them on newspapers, mm-hmm. media companies for certain things that they use like ink and paper, old fashioned things like that. And the Supreme Court has said that you can't do that, that that's an undue tax that you're levying on the press and yeah. you're violating the First Amendment. That's what these big companies are saying right out of the gate, that this kind of tax, besides being almost, you know, it's just kind of unprecedented as far as how yeah. you enforce it. They say it's illegal, too.
Yeah, yeah. And some experts that you and our colleague Franz Spielman spoke with are saying similar sentiments, that the social media tax, essentially, it's not going to make the grade in court.
Right. But it's hard to say. I mean, you know, I think a lot of folks looking at this would say that Facebook isn't necessarily what they think of as a newspaper, that, you know, we're talking about multi-billion-dollar companies that make money off taking your data and selling it to other companies. That's not what our newspaper does, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what I talked to a state senator in Minnesota who's co-authored their bill. And basically his argument is, you know, we tax companies for mining iron out of the mountains because you're taking a natural good. These companies are mining your data and they should have to pay something for that.
What are the mayor's advisors and budget folks saying about this? Because they're insisting that this is an amusement tax.
Right. So they're clearly going to go with a different legal argument if it gets to that point.
Okay.
Again, we got another couple months ahead of us of budget talks. It's going to be a slog, and this is already facing some pushback. But their argument, is that the city slaps a tax on your ticket to a Bulls game because that's an amusement. And their argument is that you go on Facebook for amusement to look at funny videos and things on TikTok, and that's how they're classifying it.
I go on Facebook to talk to my family.
That's one way to amuse yourself, especially with the holidays coming up.
And look at baby photos and vacation pics.
Tax, you know?
All right. Yesterday on In the Loop, we did a deep dive on the city's proposed corporate head tax. You can find that conversation. It's on our podcast, and it's at weez.org/in the loop. This is essentially an extra charge of $21 per month per employee for large corporations, businesses with more than 100 employees. Claire, it has a pretty high-profile opponent, doesn't it?
Yes, that would be Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who says it's a bad idea. So while Johnson is saying that this head tax could raise $100 million a year for mental health and violence prevention services, Pritzker is saying that head taxes make it harder to attract businesses from outside of the city, right? And he says it would make it more difficult for existing companies to want to stay in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So Chicago's last head tax was phased out in 2014, and Pritzker is essentially pretty adamant about not wanting to revive it, because it would be a revival.
Yeah, and it would be a lot more than it was back in 2014.
Certainly.
Your takeaways, Mitch, from what Pritzker had to say at the Economic Club of Chicago?
I think that there was already a steep hill to try and get that passed. This mm-hmm. is something that hasn't been in place in the city for more than a decade. I think it's kind of hard to explain, even to a layman, that, you know, we should charge big companies for coming in and creating a lot of jobs. I think that the mayor should probably look elsewhere, or at least have a fallback plan to make up $100 million in his budget.
Yeah, again, if you want to hear arguments on both sides, I do encourage you to check out our podcast. Wherever you get your pods, just find In the Loop, or again, weez.org/in the loop. Now, as we talk city budget, Juan Pablo, we've got a major financial issue that's brewing at the federal level. Day 22 of this government shutdown. Can you believe it?
Yeah, I sure can.
You cover the environment. Tell me the effect that it's having on those workers.
Yeah, that's right. So federal employees at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency got furlough notices earlier this week. It's estimated that about 64% of the EPA is currently furloughed. So that includes the entirety of the enforcement arm. So think the workers that are in charge of protecting the air, the water, the soil, from things like, yep, you guessed it, pollution.
Yeah.
You know, here in Chicago, where the EPA's Midwest office is located, I heard estimates that about 70% of the entire office is furloughed. And as a reminder, during government shutdowns, federal employees that are not considered essential to preserve human life or government property are furloughed without pay until Congress can pass a budget.
Yeah, that's the really tough part. I remember the beginning portion of this shutdown, just talk about the EPA was, okay, well, they're good, especially workers here in our area, they're good until around the 17th. If the shutdown goes past that, that's when we get to the danger point. But here we are at, what, October 22nd?
So, yeah, and people are feeling the pain, and the environment isn't protected the way it's supposed to be.
So, Violet, I want to turn to immigration enforcement. A state rep found himself in the crosshairs. He was attempting to alert people in his Northwest Side neighborhood about ICE. Then what happened?
Yeah, so 13th District State Rep Han Nguyen said that he found himself on the other end of a federal agent's gun shortly before video starts that was shared with the Sun-Times, which shows agents surrounding a vehicle with him and his staffers inside. Mm-hmm. These agents, at least one of them, taking photos of the folks inside the vehicle before the cars that had boxed them in start moving again. And actually, I just got a statement from DHS, right as we sat down for this, saying that the state rep had been following federal agents around, and so they stopped him not once but twice. They say that there was a warning given beforehand. The state rep said there was not. But this is not—
Like a warning, we're going to put our gun in your face?
Warning, essentially, to stop following them, right? Mm. And so this is not anything new. I mean, we've seen weapons pointed at protesters at Broadview. We've seen them pointed at the press. And these are live fire weapons we're talking about, not less than lethal.
I just saw a video yesterday of a pregnant woman on, I think, TikTok, them pointing a gun at her as well.
Yeah. So again, this is not anything new, but that shouldn't mean that it ever stops being shocking. But this is to kind of amount how much this is happening. Like, Alderwoman Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez, whose ward encompasses the area of Albany Park where the state rep had a gun pulled on him, she was also stopped yesterday by federal agents. And just yesterday, Alderwoman Jesse Fuentes also filed a $100,000 federal tort, which is a prelude to a federal lawsuit, mm-hmm. After she was detained earlier this month by federal agents trying to check in on a constituent of hers who was being detained.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, in a hearing Monday, ICE and Border Patrol officials, they say no agent has been disciplined for excessive use of force of any kind thus far during this Operation Midway Blitz. So no use of force when they throw tear gas or point guns and other weapons at people. Mitch, I wonder if these agents will ever be held accountable.
It's hard to say because who's going to hold them to account? I mean, the Trump administration has gutted inspector general's offices that typically would handle this kind of thing. And you certainly wouldn't expect suburban police departments or even big city police departments like the CPD to investigate the federal government. That's certainly an argument that the federal government would make. It's at this point, it looks like there's just going to be so many open-ended questions, mm-hmm. so many investigations. I mean, you just can't keep pace. The only cases that we, in the media, a lot of times are hearing about are the ones that people come to us with or that you see on social media.
That's right.
I mean, it's hard to kind of fathom what's going on that's not being captured on video.
We are desperately trying to follow a crazy bouncing ball here. Now, the state election board, Mitch, is deadlocked. This is on whether to fine Illinois Senate President Don Harmon $10 million. What's that story?
So Don Harmon is one of the biggest political fundraisers in Illinois. He's one of the biggest power brokers. He's a Democrat in Oak Park. He's the president of the Senate. And in Illinois, there are limits on how much individuals and companies can give to political campaigns. It's usually around $6,000 or so. Mm-hmm. But there's a law on the books that basically says when a candidate becomes self-funded, when they throw in more than $100,000 into their own campaign, that race no longer has any caps. The caps are lifted. And the idea being that, if you're up against a big rich guy like J.B. Pritzker or somebody else who can just kind of put endless money into their campaign, mm-hmm. then you can solicit big companies, other individuals to give you more money than normally you'd be allowed to. The way it's actually used in practice in Illinois is big spenders, specifically from the Democratic Party usually, where, who controls supermajorities, all statewide elected offices in the state. They can just take in huge amounts of money. Mm. That's all to say that the caps are lifted in Illinois during an election cycle. The question with President Harmon is how long is an election cycle?
How long is an election cycle?
He lifted the caps in his race ahead of the primary last year, but he kept on accepting money through the general election, which the state board says that the caps were back in place after the primary. So they've tried to fine him $10 million. He argues that he wasn't on the ballot that year, that the caps should still be lifted even right now. So we're really kind of getting deep into the weeds of state election law.
Let's stick with Springfield, Claire. No solve on this so-called transit cliff for the Chicago area public transit yet.
Right. So lawmakers are heading back to Springfield next week for the second half of their fall veto session. And Pritzker was really adamant yesterday at the Chicago Economic Club about wanting state lawmakers to really prioritize this public transit, deficit that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess there's been our fiscal cliff, right, Mitch, that we love to call it. It's shrunken, but the public transportation agencies are still warning of service cuts and layoffs. And, we need more revenue. So a measure addressing all this did pass in the Senate in May, but stalled in the House. Essentially, that measure included a controversial statewide climate impact fee on retail deliveries, which the House didn't have time to review before that May 31st deadline. So now in Springfield, this is going to need a 3/5 majority to pass whatever it is that they come up with, rather than that simple majority the Senate's bill got a few months ago. But we also know that prices are going to go up, at least across Metro,
PACE, and CTA. Yeah, fair increase.
Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, it sounds like that could be helpful, but more money, more problems.
Yeah, my daughter's dreading that extra, 25 cents? Yeah. Juan Pablo, positive news. Illinois is one step closer to keeping invasive carp out of the Great Lakes.
Sasha, let's talk carp. All right. Yes. So last week, the state of Illinois got its hands on a 2.75-acre parcel near the Des Plaines River, right by Joliet.
Okay.
Now, this is important because this land the state needs to build a $1 billion underwater defense system to keep a family of invasive carp from continuing upstream and into the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of people are worried about this because if the carp, people say, make it into the Great Lakes, they could totally upend the lake's multi-billion dollar fisheries and tourism economy. So there's good reason to want to stop them in their tracks. Now, it's not all good news.
Ugh.
The site of that $1 billion underwater barricade I mentioned, it may be impacted by nearby hazardous waste, and the state of Illinois would have to pick up the check on the remediation of that site.
Sheesh.
State officials told us, though, that they're currently investigating it to figure out what exactly comes next.
Well, it's still positive overall.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. What else are you watching, Claire?
Yeah, so a big story today. Attorneys representing the Trump administration agreed, and this was yesterday, to a potential 30-day extension of an order that temporarily blocks the deployment of National Guard troops in the Chicago area. So this comes ahead of U.S. District Judge April Perry's hearing, which is scheduled for 9 a.m. this morning. I guess it's already happening now, to decide if her 2-week order should be extended. I know Violet is watching this as well. Trump lawyers also say they want to wait until the U.S. Supreme Court is going to weigh in before discussing any next steps. And that's according to Tuesday court filings as well. But as we know here in Chicago, lawyers are arguing, and asking the U.S. Supreme Court to block the Trump administration's request to allow the deployment. They don't want guard troops here. They're even calling it dramatic.
Yeah, which it is.
Yeah. So we're definitely going to have more on what's happening after this hearing later this morning.
Mm-hmm. Violet, we are seeing immigration arrests happen all over the place, near schools, too. There was one on the far north side yesterday. What are the details?
Yeah, so we don't have a ton of details. We just know outside Decatur Classical School in West Ridge, so far, far northwest side of the city, we saw a CPS vendor employee be detained by federal agents. According to an email from the school to the school community that we obtained, they said that they confirmed this was a vendor's employee and that none of the students saw or interacted with federal agents during this. DHS told me that they're not going to schools to go after children, but obviously those fears have remained. I mean, we've seen them pick up parents in school pickup lines and target other folks around schools, such as this case.
Yeah, definitely reason to have fear there. And of course, so much swirling, Violet, on ICE and arrests and Border Patrol. And of course, as Claire just talked about, possible deployment of the National Guard. What else are you keeping an eye on? I'm sure the temporary restraining order. That's one.
Yeah, that's number one on my list. We've got a preliminary injunction hearing set for November 5th. So that would be a potentially stronger follow-up to this temporary restraining order that's been set. Though District Court Judge Sarah Ellis said just a few days ago she has serious concerns about whether her order restricting agents from using, less lethal rubber bullets, chemical munitions, things things like that on protesters, press, and the general public. She said she had concerns that's even being followed. So on Friday, we got some more details about, if these agents will have to use body cameras going forward, but there are a lot of exceptions to that. So really just watching to see how that all plays out and if this preliminary injunction goes into place November 5th, which, yeah, again, could be a stronger arm against the government.
Mm-hmm. What are you keeping an eye on, Mitch? I'm curious, because you've been covering so much lately.
I guess I'm just curious to see what other tools does J.B. Pritzker and Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul have in the tank, This court battle, it's kind of interesting. Just after a certain point, even if they do get this temporary restraining order, there are other avenues for the Trump administration to deploy troops.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk in recent weeks about invoking the Insurrection Act, which is would kind of be, dropping the atomic bomb, metaphorically speaking. And there's really, that's such a broad legal space that has been so rarely invoked that would just kind of, It would just create a whole new court fight. But it could potentially make things a lot easier for the Trump administration to get a foothold here.
Not to mention, this is all still continuing while the courts play this out.
That's right. Yeah, very interesting points. And before we wrap, Juan Pablo, you have been doing, I got to say, you've been doing some stellar reporting over the past few months on lead pipes in Chicago. Shout out to you. Some great digital displays online to help us all figure out what's going on in and around our homes. You've been talking about how long it's been taking for the city to replace them, where they are. What is the latest, though, on the city's efforts to replace these lead pipes?
Yeah, it's been a lead pipe summer, and it's going to wrap up a lead pipe fall. We're currently reporting the last story in the lead pipe series, and this one's about why it's so expensive to replace lead pipes here in Chicago. The city estimates it can cost something like $35,000. This is like for a single lead pipe for a single home, right?
Oh, yeah.
We've seen it go up to like $40,000, too. So we're trying to figure out what makes that price balloon up so much. So if you're hearing this and you have an idea or you know why, please, please, please get in touch with us. We want to hear from you.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/In the Loop. Thanks for listening.